now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I'm speaking to you from Warsaw with the latest game podcast from Euro 2012. It's been another fascinating few days. We've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And stupid cliches aside, I think we're seeing one hell of a tournament, but I'll be discussing that further with my guest today. We've got two of our in-house journalistic powerhouses. It's Matt Hughes, and of course, it's George Calkin. We'll be covering that huge game between Holland and Germany, and some of the trouble between Poland and Russia. But why don't we start with England? And Matt, it's logical to start with you since you're with England. England and Sweden, obviously after that initial draw, which ultimately I thought was a good result, better than the performance certainly. Is Ibrahimovic scaring anybody?
Didn't scare me, but I'd have to play against him. He looked, he's rarely done it against English teams, but he looked pretty good on Monday against Ukraine, and as we've seen with his comments afterwards, he's pretty fired up for this tournament and angry after that defeat, so I think he will cause problems. Terry and Lescott did very well against Benzema, but Ibrahimovic represents a different challenge.
George, you used to cover him, you've seen things over the years. I'm always interested in how confidence seems to play a part in a certain way with England teams. Does the fact that Zlatan has, over the years, been presented in English media, some kind of flat-track bully who can't do it against England and so on, in your experience, does that come into the minds of the players? I mean, regardless of whether it's true or not, but does it come into the minds of the players and do they tend to benefit and feel stronger against him because they just don't think he's as good?
I'm not sure if it works like that. I mean, I do think that there's more of a kind of concentration on their own performances, their own team, their own shape. And I think in some ways that's been a failing for England over the years, that there hasn't been sort of, I mean, not that they're not well prepared, because I'm sure that they are, but there is this sort of almost sort of isolationism. And I mean, one thing that we know about Roy Hodgson, I mean, A, from the games that we've seen so far, England will be very well drilled and disciplined and organised, but also, you know, they will pay attention to the opposition. They will, he will sort of provide sort of in-depth analysis of that kind of thing. So I'm sure they'll be made aware of him. But, you know, as per usual, it'll be a case of, I think, concentrating on their own ability and trying to do it that way.
If they focus on their own ability, I'm assuming we're all expecting them to do what they did against France. In other words, perhaps sit deep and try to get something on the counter. In light of that, do you expect the same personnel?
I think it will be the same team, yes. We watched training yesterday, and the first team that played against France sort of managed 20 minutes and then went off to rest, which suggests Hodgson's not planning many tactical changes, because he certainly didn't work on them yesterday. They have one training session at the stadium in Kiev this afternoon, and that's very much it. I think they might try and be slightly more expansive. They had one shot on goal against France, and were fortunate that Lescott's header went in, so they're going to have to try and be a bit more creative. Maybe Oxlade-Chamberlain will be given a little bit more license to come inside and look for the ball rather than working from down the touchline as he did. I think the key also is to try and get Ashley Young into the game more. He was very isolated against France, and I think he only touched the ball 15 times.
Hughes, I'm going to follow up with you because I was struck by something. I caught some of the TV and radio coverage of the first game, and they all praised Danny Welbeck to high heaven. And then I pick up my copy of the Times, and you did the ratings, and I saw that you gave him a 5, which isn't a very good rating. I'm wondering, what do you make of Welbeck? And might this be the kind of game where you actually go with Carroll, perhaps? And part of the reason I'm suggesting that is that for some bizarre statistical reason, we're on pace for 34-headed goals in this European Championships, which is twice as much as the previous record. And if this is the Euros of aerial bombardment, and again, it might just be a statistical quirk, might England be better off with the big, scary centre-forward rather than the smaller, gifted one?
I think, given the way England are going to play, which is sitting very deep and having basically one up front, despite Ashley Young being notionally a striker, I think they're going to need more mobility than Carroll offers, which is why they're going to stick with Welbeck. I mean, I thought actually Welbeck did do okay. I thought he worked very, very hard. I thought he didn't hold the ball up as well as he could have done, hence maybe he got a slightly lower mark. But I know, I think he did reasonably well, and we'll get another chance. I'm fine talking about crosses, but if you've got James Milner on one wing and the right footed Oxlade-Chamberlain on the other, then you're probably not going to get great service to Carroll anyway. So I think that's another reason I'll stick with Welbeck.
Well, Mike Hughes has always been a bit of a harsh grader, of course, but George, you have more intimate knowledge of Andy Carroll, and not necessarily biblical knowledge, but he's there for a reason. Do you think he's just a late game sub, or is he somebody who could start? Or once Rooney comes back, is he basically going to be there to be the tourist?
Well, I think the qualities that we know he's got makes him a sort of ideal game changer as a substitute. That's for certain. I mean, I think Hughes's got far more kind of intimate knowledge of the way England are set up and the way England are playing. But we do know that if there comes a stage in a game when Hodgson needs to change something, bringing on Andy Carroll is going to facilitate a change of tactics. And you know, I don't think any defender, I mean, without kind of going into cliche too much, I don't think many defenders in this tournament would kind of relish the prospect of kind of playing this 6-foot-something monster coming on for the last 20 minutes of a game. I mean, it might be a sign of desperation if he is coming on, but you know, we know that he's going to win the ball in the air. We know that he'll make life difficult, and he does provide Hodgson with a kind of completely different game plan. I think that's the attraction of him. You know, having seen him at Newcastle in those first 6 months back in the Premier League, he was unplayable at times, and it's taken him a long time to kind of find himself at Liverpool. But you know, it's kind of good that he's here in a bit of form, and I'm sure he'll be, you know, absolutely determined to make an impact if and when he gets a chance. But yeah, no, I think he provides something different. That's the attraction. He's not a like for like change.
All right, enough England. We had two tremendous games yesterday. We've had very good games in the tournament. Hughesy, I want to ask you. Portugal, I mean, they certainly got a huge scare against Denmark. And what I thought was incredible was that miss towards the end from Cristiano. I hate to say he doesn't do it at tournament level. And I really thought this was the one where, you know, things would work out for him. He'd had a good season. He'd sort of approach a tournament slightly under the limelight. I mean, Portugal are definitely in it. That 3-2 win puts them right there. They need to get a result against Holland, who are nearly out. But are you surprised by the tournament Ronaldo's had? Is just the wrong guy in the wrong place? And you know, what do you say to a superstar who kind of misses a one-on-one the way he did late in the game?
Well, I thought given the year he's had in Madrid, 60-odd goals, finally earning a title. I thought this could be his tournament, but it's just not worked out for him. I think he clearly suffers from Portugal's reliance on him, which might sound daft given they won 3-2 in a game he didn't perform very well, but you know what I mean, they haven't got a great centre forward, so they're going to look to rely on not only to create the goals but score the goals, and I think he suffers under that pressure.
George, Germany roll on 6 points, they're just about there, although they believe there's some kind of weirdo mathematical combination where they might not actually qualify, but so far so good. They got the the two tough games out of the way. They won, and I thought they looked better against Holland. Did you still have them up there among the favorites? And is Mario Gomez the answer?
Well, I certainly do have them up there favorites. They were the beneficiaries of my tenor before this tournament started. I know they were for quite a few people, but nothing that's happened so far would see me want to move that bet. No, I really enjoyed watching it last night. They've got great movement, fluidity, and you know they're a pleasure to watch. It's been sort of interesting watching their sort of rediscovery or their sort of re-emergence since Germany in 2006. But you know they're pleasing on the eye. They've got a striker in great form, and I think they're the ones to beat so far.
Husey, did you agree with that, or was it a case of Holland playing a ridiculously bad system against that's just completely unsuited to play in Germany, and basically the big players for Holland, too many of them playing on their own? Because I got the sense that Snyder papered over the cracks, obviously, in 2010, and they got a bit of luck and whatever else. But once again, you know, you've got Robin playing by himself, you've got Van Persie, I mean, great goal aside, not really fitting in. You got the two guys in front of the back four just standing around defending. And you have, I think, what must be one of the worst back fours at the Euros.
Well, I agree, Holland weren't great, and they're so profligate in attack. Robin must miss sort of half a dozen chances every game when he cuts inside and whacks it over the bar or puts it wider than the near post. And he's obviously had a pretty terrible month since signing that new contract at Bayern. But having said that, I was massively impressed with Germany. I was talking to Michael Ballack for a piece about them before the tournament, and he made the point that they are a bit like Spain, a kind of complete all-round team, and they can hurt you from anywhere. If you contrast Schweinsteiger and Cadera as nominally holding players to the sort of very statuesque, slow De Jong and Van Bommel, then there really is no comparison. Schweinsteiger played such a lovely ball with Gomez, and they're just a really good football team. And when you've got Gomez on form, they've got cutting edge as well, closer to come off the bench. He's got an incredible record at tournaments, so it's difficult to find any weaknesses with them, really. And you really would fancy them going.
The train is now approaching Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A long way in this tournament.
Yeah, only weakness, as you said, that perhaps Gomez's form might go at some point. I know they'd be quite as fluid against a different opponent. And also, Mats Hummels, one of my favorite players in the world, showed his humanity there with one or two bad mistakes against the Dutch. But I agree with you. I expect Germany to bounce back comprehensively. On a slightly less pleasant note, I was here in Warsaw for the Poland-Russia game, and there definitely was trouble. I think the decision to allow these Russian fans to march was simply idiotic. Kind of naturally, people here saw it as a provocation. There's probably hundreds of years of history, and whether you think it's a provocation or not, I think it's hard to deny that for some of the lunatics who just want to get into rucks and smash people's heads in, it's the perfect excuse to go and attack Russian fans, many of whom, or some of whom anyway, were there and kind of relished the fight. Now, George, we're not really used to seeing this kind of thing at a major tournament. I certainly thought we'd kind of moved past that. And then I think you probably have to go back to Charleroi and, England fans, back in 2000 to find the last instance of this on this scale. Are you surprised? And is this a one-off, as we all hope?
Well, I certainly hope those scenes that we saw in Warsaw are a one-off, where there was kind of sort of fighting outside a stadium. I mean, I have to say that there is a. As soon as I arrived in Poland, I was kind of struck by the sort of difference in atmosphere. Now, sort of, you know, I should absolutely make it clear that sort of the overwhelming sensation is of being welcomed and being made. You know, it's been kind of a great welcome for everybody. But there's a sort of cultural tradition, it seems, of drinking on the street and. That I was kind of amazed when I first arrived in Sopot, which is it's a coastal resort. It's close to Gdansk. It's a very nice part of the world. But young people are out on the street drinking, and they're doing it sort of throughout the day. This was before the tournament started, and it kind of made me feel a little bit nervous, I suppose. And I have seen instances of just small localized. Fighting between local people, actually, and this was before the tournament started. So, I mean, I think that's just there in the background. And, you know, naturally, when you then put football fans often drinking into that same sort of mix, then there's obvious worries there. Now, having said all that, I'm following the Republic of Ireland around, and there were 15,000-20,000 of their fans in Poznan last week. I was in the main square with them. The night before their game, and you know there were 14 arrests. Now, 14 arrests when you've got 20,000 fans and thousands of other fans there as well, actually, isn't that much. So I hope that what we've seen is a kind of one-off event. You know, obviously with a bit of history about it, but at the same time, to the people who are here or coming out of here, I would just sort of advise common sense, really.
George, did you just say you're surprised by seeing? Young people out on the street drinking, because I don't know. I obviously we live in different parts of England, but where I live, you see plenty of that. Does that not happen in the Northeast?
Yes, it does. No. Well, it does, but I mean, it's more. I mean, more. You know, if you went out in Newcastle, you would see people moving about from bar to bar. So what struck me was the number of people actually drinking from glass bottles and walking around drinking as a pastime, as opposed to walking around from one place to another to drink. I think that was the sort of difference, and it was happening. It was happening from sort of early in the evening. I'd, you know, absolutely. I'm from the northeast of England, which has a kind of vibrant drinking and social scene. So I'm very well versed, very familiar with that scene, and indeed partaking in it. But I was kind of struck. I was struck very early on by the scale of it here, and you know, people standing around on the street drinking.
Hughie, so it's interesting because with the violence, which I mean, UEFA really were not expecting, but after, what's interesting is that they've had to act with FAs almost as if they were clubs. So after that horrible video, which I'm sure you've probably seen, of the Russian hooligans beating up those four stewards in Lviv, Russia have been fined and given a 6-point suspended sentence in the next European qualifier. That's a suspended sentence that doesn't really mean anything if they behave. Although if something bad happens, 6 points is pretty huge, and that could well mean that they don't qualify for 2016. But now they've opened another inquiry after the violence in Warsaw. And also over that, I don't know, I'm assuming you guys saw it, that huge banner, which was sort of unfurled, which I admit looked very cool and kind of threatening. But if somebody came to my house in my country and unfurled a banner that said, you know, this is Russia, with a picture of some weirdo 17th century political leader or his military leader who fought against Polish forces and blah, 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 I would kind of take that as an affront. Somebody made the analogy. If those had been German fans unfurling a giant banner of the, you know, the German war eagle or somebody equally unsavory with like the sign, this is Germany, people would have been pretty angry. Do you expect UEFA to punish Russia again over this? And how'd they get that big thing in the stadium in the first place?
I find it absolutely staggering that UEFA are surprised there was violence and crowd trouble, given where we are in the world, in Ukraine and Poland, where there is endemic problems at football matches. But particularly at that match, as you say, you've got Russian fans marching. A march should never have allowed to take place, in a very aggressive manner, and unveiling a flag saying this is Russia in a country that was effectively ruled from Moscow for 70, 80 years. It's absolutely incredible that these things were allowed to happen, and the UEFA claimed to be surprised, and it shows that they're frankly incompetent and shouldn't be running the tournament. It also casts big questions over, worrying question marks over 2018 and the World Cup. But I don't want to come over as a bitter and twisted English football reporter, but FIFA taking the tournament for Russia, given the violence we've seen involving Russian fans in the last few days, I think it's quite worrying.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know, I just thought there was real ugliness to the banner. I mean, there was no violence whatsoever inside the stadium or immediately next to the stadium. It was sort of during the march on the way to the city center over this bridge to the stadium. And, you know, they passed it on to the police. They dealt with it as best they should. And with hindsight, I think they screwed up there. I was just, but that banner, because we see the uglier side of the nationalism. But to end it on a positive note, this is my 7th major tournament, counting Euros and World Cups. George, what number are you at? And is this the best one you've seen at this stage? At this stage of the competition?
Numbers. Well, I've done every one since 2000, barring the European Championships in 2008 when England weren't here. Absolutely loving it. As I said before, I'm covering Ireland, and that's a joy to be part of that. But if not their football hasn't been. But It's been thrilling, and it's been thrilling watching it. It's been thrilling watching the other games on the TV. Really enjoyed it, and you know, it's easy to be cynical in our job, and I guess a bit of that is fine when it's healthy. But I have to say that when I was in the stadium in Poznan for Ireland's game against Croatia, the noise, the atmosphere, the colour, the sort of excitement, the sense of being part of something big, found it pretty overwhelming, I have to say. Yeah. And the quality of the football so far has been excellent.
Unfortunately, sometimes real life interferes with a fantasy bubble that is the European Championships, and we've had it happen once again. Harry Redknapp, no longer the Tottenham Hotspur manager. Hughesy, 3 months ago, y'all thought he was great. People wanted him to succeed Fabio Capello as England manager, although obviously the FA didn't. Now all of a sudden he's thrown to the curve like his dog Rosie was, with nothing but £3 million in compensation to cheer him up. How did we get to this?
Well, it's a surprise from the outside, given what he's achieved and given how high his reputation was very recently. But if you know the personalities involved and the relationship between Redknapp and Daniel Levy, it's not really a surprise. There's always been tension in the relationship over transfer targets and money to be spent, and they've had very specific problems over the last few months. In February, when the England job first came up, Tottenham tried to get Redknapp to sign a new contract so they would get compensation in the event of the FA coming in. He wasn't interested. Then when he didn't get the job in May, he went on to them and was very proactive and almost aggressive in demanding a four-year contract. That went down very badly with Daniel Levy, and he made it clear he wasn't going to get anything. Levy was also unhappy with the way that Tottenham imploded and blew a 13-point lead over Arsenal to finish fourth, which in the event wasn't good enough for Champions League football. So those combination of those two factors meant that the relationship was broken down, and given there was no intention on Spurs' part to extend, it was almost inevitable that he would leave, and he was basically sacked yesterday. It's a bold move from Tottenham, and it will put pressure on them to get a good manager in. Looks like it would be David Moyes, who will be under pressure himself to do well, but I think he can do that.
So we've got time for, so thank you for listening. And yeah, that includes you, Roberto Di Matteo, who's got a two-year contract to be the new, in inverted quotas, Chelsea manager, just a few months after winning the Champions League. Funny that. I'll be back on Monday, where we'll have a better sense of England's future. In the meantime, you can visit www.thetimes.co.uk. You can follow us all on Twitter. Jump in there and say hi. Tell us what you think about the podcast. And download our iPad app. It's kind of like a newspaper with buttons, graphics, and all kinds of fancy features. Till next time, bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.